Welcome to Quillette Narrated. The following article is How French Intellectuals Ruined the West, written by Helen Pluckrose, read by Iona Italia. Editor's note by me, Iona Italia. The following essay first appeared in Ario magazine in March 2017 and is reproduced here with the author's permission. In this piece, Helen Pluckrose outlined some of the arguments later explored in depth in her best-selling 2020 book Cynical Theories, co-authored with James Lindsay. The essay charts the pernicious influence of postmodernist thinking on two generations of academics and activists. If you want to understand how we got to a place where microaggressions are denounced as violence, but the brutal terrorism of an intifada is considered righteous, this is an important primer. How French Intellectuals Ruined the West. Postmodernism presents a threat not only to liberal democracy, but to modernity itself. That may sound like a bold or even a hyperbolic claim, but the reality is that the cluster of ideas and values at the root of postmodernism have broken the bounds of academia and gained great cultural power in Western society. The irrational and identitarian symptoms of postmodernism are easily recognizable and much criticized, but the ethos underlying them is not well understood. This is partly because postmodernists rarely explain themselves clearly, and partly because of the inherent contradictions and inconsistencies of a way of thought that denies that a stable reality or reliable knowledge exist. However, there are consistent ideas at the root of postmodernism, and understanding them is essential if we intend to counter them. They underlie the problems we see today in social justice activism, undermine the credibility of the left, and threaten to return us to an irrational and tribal pre-modern culture. Postmodernism, most simply, is an artistic and philosophical movement which began in France in the 1960s and produced bewildering art and even more bewildering theory. It drew on avant-garde and surrealist art and earlier philosophical ideas, particularly those of Nietzsche and Heidegger, for its anti-realism and rejection of the concept of the unified and coherent individual. It reacted against the liberal humanism of the modernist artistic and intellectual movements, which its proponents saw as naively universalizing a Western, middle-class, and male experience. It rejected philosophy, which valued ethics, reason, and clarity, with the same accusation. Structuralism, a movement which, often overconfidently, attempted to analyze human culture and psychology according to consistent structures of relationships, came under attack. Marxism, with its understanding of society through class and economic structures, was regarded as equally rigid and simplistic. Above all, postmodernists attacked science and its goal of obtaining objective knowledge about a reality that exists independently of human perceptions, which they saw as merely another form of constructed ideology dominated by bourgeois Western assumptions. Decidedly left-wing, postmodernism had both a nihilistic and a revolutionary ethos, which resonated with the post-war, post-empire zeitgeist in the West. As postmodernism continued to develop and diversify, its initially stronger nihilistic deconstructive phase became secondary, but still fundamental, to its revolutionary identity politics phase. It has been a matter of contention whether postmodernism is a reaction against modernity. The modern era is the period of history which saw Renaissance humanism, the Enlightenment, the scientific revolution, and the development of liberal values and human rights. The period when Western societies gradually came to value reason and science over faith and superstition as routes to knowledge, and developed a concept of the person as an individual member of the human race, deserving of rights and freedoms, rather than as part of various collectives subject to rigid hierarchical roles in society. The Encyclopaedia Britannica says postmodernism, quote, is largely a reaction against the philosophical assumptions and values of the modern period of Western, specifically European, history. Whilst the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy denies this and says, rather its differences lie within modernity itself, and postmodernism is a continuation of modern thinking in another mode. I'd suggest that the difference lies in whether we see modernity in terms of what was produced or what was destroyed. If we see the essence of modernity as the development of science and reason, as well as humanism and universal liberalism, postmodernists are opposed to it. If we see modernity as the tearing down of structures of power, including feudalism, the church, patriarchy, and empire, postmodernists are attempting to continue it. But their targets are now science, reason, humanism, and liberalism. Consequently, the roots of postmodernism are inherently political and revolutionary, albeit in a destructive, or as they would term it, deconstructive way. Jean-François Lyotard. The term postmodern was coined by Jean-François Lyotard in his 1979 book, The Postmodern Condition. He defined the postmodern condition as, quote, an incredulity towards meta-narratives. A meta-narrative is a wide-ranging and cohesive explanation for large phenomena. Religions and other totalizing ideologies are meta-narratives in their attempts to explain the meaning of life or all of society's ills. Lyotard advocated replacing these with, quote, mini-narratives to get at smaller and more personal truths. He addressed Christianity and Marxism in this way, but also science. In his view, quote, there is a strict interlinkage between the kind of language called science and the kind called ethics and politics. By tying science, the knowledge it produces, to government and power, he rejects its claim to objectivity. Lyotard describes this incredulous postmodern condition as a general one, and argues that from the end of the 19th century, quote, an internal erosion of the legitimacy principle of knowledge began to cause a change in the status of knowledge. By the 1960s, the resulting doubt and demoralization of scientists, in Lyotard's words, had, quote, made an impact on the central problem of legitimization. No number of scientists telling him they are not demoralized, nor any more doubtful than befits the practitioners of method whose results are always provisional and whose hypotheses are never proven, could sway him from this. We see in Lyotard an explicit epistemic relativism, belief in personal or culturally specific truths or facts, and the advocacy of privileging, quote, lived experience over empirical evidence. We see, too, the promotion of a version of pluralism that privileges the views of minority groups over the general consensus of scientists or liberal democratic ethics, which are presented as authoritarian and dogmatic. This is consistent in postmodern thought. Michel Foucault. Michel Foucault's work is also centered on language and relativism, although he applied this to history and culture. He called this approach archaeology because he saw himself as, quote, uncovering aspects of historical culture through recorded discourses, speech that promotes or assumes a particular view. For Foucault, discourses control what can be known, and in different periods and places, different systems of institutional power control discourses. Therefore, knowledge is a direct product of power. Quote, in any given culture and at any given moment, there is always only one episteme that defines the conditions of possibility of all knowledge, whether expressed in theory or silently invested in a practice. Furthermore, people themselves were culturally constructed. Quote, the individual, with his identity and characteristics, is the product of a relation of power exercised over bodies, multiplicities, movements, desires, forces. He leaves almost no room for individual agency or autonomy. As Christopher Butler says, Foucault, quote, relies on beliefs about the inherent evil of the individual's class position or professional position, seen as discourse, regardless of the morality of his or her individual conduct. He presents medieval feudalism and modern liberal democracies equally oppressive, and advocates criticizing and attacking institutions to unmask the, quote, political violence that has always exercised itself obscurely through them. We see in Foucault the most extreme expression of cultural relativism, read through structures of power in which shared humanity and individuality are almost entirely absent. Instead, people are constructed by their position in relation to dominant cultural ideas, either as oppressors or oppressed. Judith Butler drew on Foucault for her foundational role in queer theory, focusing on the culturally constructed nature of gender, as did Edward Said in his similar role in postcolonialism and Orientalism, and Kimberly Crenshaw in her development of intersectionality and advocacy of identity politics. We see, too, the equation of language with violence and coercion, and the equation of reason and universal liberalism with oppression. Jacques Derrida. It was Jacques Derrida who introduced the concept of deconstruction, and he too argued for cultural constructivism and cultural and personal relativism. He focuses even more explicitly on language. Derrida's best-known pronouncement, "There is no outside text," relates to his rejection of the idea that words refer to anything straightforwardly. Rather, quote, "there are only contexts without any center of absolute anchoring." Therefore, the author of a text is not the authority on its meaning. The reader or listener makes their own equally valid meaning, and every text, quote, "engenders infinitely new contexts in an absolutely non-saturable fashion." Derrida coined the term différence, which he derived from the verb différer, which means both to defer and to differ. This was to indicate that not only is meaning never final, but it is constructed by differences, specifically by oppositions. The word young only makes sense in its relation with the word old, and he argued, following Saussure, that meaning is constructed by the conflict of these elemental oppositions, which to him always form a positive and negative. Man is positive and woman negative. Occident is positive and Orient negative. He insisted that we are not dealing with a peaceful coexistence of vis-a-vis, but rather with a violent hierarchy. One of the two terms governs the other, axiologically, logically, etc., or has the upper hand. To deconstruct the opposition, first of all, is to overturn the hierarchy at a given moment. Deconstruction, therefore, involves inverting these perceived hierarchies, making woman and Orient positive, and man and Occident negative. This is to be done ironically, to reveal the culturally constructed and arbitrary nature of these perceived oppositions in unequal conflict. We see in Derrida further relativism, both cultural and epistemic, and further justification for identity politics. There is an explicit denial that differences can be other than oppositional, and therefore a rejection of Enlightenment liberalism's values of overcoming differences and focusing on universal human rights and individual freedom and empowerment. We see here the basis of, quote, "ironic misandry," and the mantra, "reverse racism isn't real," and the idea that identity dictates what can be understood. We see, too, a rejection of the need for clarity in speech and argument, and to understand the other's point of view and avoid misinterpretation. The intention of the speaker is irrelevant. What matters is the impact of speech. This, along with Foucauldian ideas, underlies the current belief in the deeply damaging nature of microaggressions and misuse of terminology related to gender, race, or sexuality. Lyotard, Foucault, and Derrida are just three of the founding fathers of postmodernism, but their ideas share common themes with other influential theorists and were taken up later by postmodernists who apply them to an increasingly diverse range of disciplines within the social sciences and humanities. We've seen that this includes an intense sensitivity to language on the level of the word, and a feeling that what the speaker means is less important than how it is received, no matter how radical the interpretation. Shared humanity and individuality are essentially illusions, and people are propagators or victims of discourses depending on their social position, a position that is dependent on identity far more than on their individual engagement with society. Morality is culturally relative, as is reality itself. Empirical evidence is suspect, and so are any culturally dominant ideas, including science, reason, and universal liberalism. These are Enlightenment values that are naive, totalizing and oppressive, and there is a moral necessity to smash them. Far more important are the lived experience, narratives, and beliefs of marginalized groups, all of which are equally quote-unquote true, but must now be privileged over Enlightenment values to reverse an oppressive, unjust, and entirely arbitrary social construction of reality, morality, and knowledge. The desire to smash the status quo, challenge widely held values and institutions, and champion the marginalized is absolutely liberal in ethos. Opposing it is resolutely conservative. This is the historical reality. But we are at a unique point in history, where the status quo is fairly consistently liberal, with a liberalism that upholds the values of freedom, equal rights, and opportunities for everyone, regardless of gender, race, or sexuality. The result is confusion, in which lifelong liberals wishing to conserve this kind of liberal status quo find themselves considered conservative, and those wishing to avoid conservatism at all costs find themselves defending irrationalism and illiberalism. Whilst the first postmodernists mostly challenge discourse with discourse, the activists motivated by their ideas are becoming more authoritarian and following those ideas to their logical conclusion. Freedom of speech is under threat because speech is now dangerous. So dangerous that people considering themselves liberal can now justify responding to it with violence. The need to argue a case persuasively using reasoned argument is now often replaced with references to identity and pure rage. Despite all the evidence that racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, and xenophobia are at an all-time low in Western societies, leftist academics and social justice activists display a fatalistic pessimism enabled by postmodern interpretative reading practices that valorize confirmation bias. The authoritarian power of the postmodern academics and activists seems to be invisible to them, whilst being apparent to everyone else. As Andrew Sullivan says of intersectionality, it posits a classic orthodoxy through which all of human experience is explained, and through which all speech must be filtered. Like the Puritanism once familiar in New England, intersectionality controls language and the very terms of discourse. Postmodernism has become a Lyotardian metanarrative, a Foucauldian system of discursive power, and a Derridean oppressive hierarchy. The logical problem of self-referentiality has been pointed out to postmodernists by philosophers fairly constantly, but it is one they have yet to address convincingly. As Christopher Butler points out, quote, the plausibility of Lyotard's claim for the decline of metanarratives in the late 20th century ultimately depends upon an appeal to the cultural condition of an intellectual minority. In other words, Lyotard's claim comes directly from the discourses surrounding him in his bourgeois academic bubble, and is, in fact, a metanarrative, towards which he is not remotely incredulous. Equally, Foucault's argument that knowledge is historically contingent must itself be historically contingent. And one wonders why Derrida bothered to explain the infinite malleability of text at such length. If I could read his entire body of work and claim it to be a story about bunny rabbits with the same degree of authority. Postmodernism in the Academy. This is, of course, not the only criticism commonly made of postmodernism. The most glaring problem of epistemic cultural relativism has been addressed by philosophers and scientists. The philosopher David Detmer, in Challenging Postmodernism, says, consider this example, provided by Erazim Kohak. When I try unsuccessfully to squeeze a tennis ball into a wine bottle, I need not try several wine bottles and several tennis balls before, using Mill's canons of induction, I arrive inductively at the hypothesis that tennis balls do not fit into wine bottles. We are now in a position to turn the tables on postmodernist claims of cultural relativism and ask, if I judge that tennis balls do not fit into wine bottles, can you show precisely how it is that my gender, historical and spatial location, class, ethnicity, etc., undermine the objectivity of this judgment? However, he has not found postmodernists committed to explaining their reasoning, and describes a bewildering conversation with postmodern philosopher Laurie Calhoun. Quote, "When I had occasion to ask her whether or not it was a fact that giraffes are taller than ants, she replied that it was not a fact, but rather an article of religious faith in our culture." Physicists Alan Sokol and Jean Briquemont address the same problem from the perspective of science in Fashionable Nonsense, Postmodern Intellectuals' Abuse of Science. Quote, "Who could now seriously deny the grand narrative of evolution, except someone in the grip of a far less plausible master narrative such as creationism? And who would wish to deny the truth of basic physics?" The answer was, some postmodernists. And, quote, "There is something very odd indeed in the belief that in looking, say, for causal laws or a unified theory, or in asking whether atoms really do obey the laws of quantum mechanics, the activities of scientists are somehow inherently bourgeois or Eurocentric or masculinist or even militarist." How much of a threat is postmodernism to science? There are certainly some external attacks. In the 2017 protests against a talk given by Charles Murray at Middlebury, the protesters chanted as one, quote, "Science has always been used to legitimize racism, sexism, classism, transphobia, ableism, and homophobia, all veiled as rational and fact and supported by the government and state. In this world today, there is little that is true fact." When the organizers of the March for Science tweeted, "Colonization, racism, immigration, native rights, sexism, ableism, queer, trans, intersex phobia, and econ justice are scientific issues," many scientists immediately criticized this politicization of science and derailment of the focus on preservation of science to intersectional ideology. In South Africa, the hashtag Science Must Fall and hashtag Decolonize Science, progressive student movement, announced that science was only one way of knowing that people had been taught to accept. They suggested witchcraft as one alternative. Despite this, science as a methodology is not going anywhere. It cannot be adapted to include epistemic relativism and alternative ways of knowing. It can, however, lose public confidence and thereby state funding, and this is a threat not to be underestimated. Also, at a time in which world rulers doubt climate change, parents believe false claims that vaccines cause autism, and people turn to homeopaths and naturopaths for solutions to serious medical conditions, it is dangerous to the degree of an existential threat to further damage people's confidence in the empirical sciences. Postmodernism and the decline of the liberal arts. Postmodernism is devouring the liberal arts. Such a deeply entrenched cultural problem cannot be solved by top-down intervention. The social sciences and humanities, however, are in danger of changing out of all recognition. Some disciplines within the social sciences already have. Cultural anthropology, sociology, cultural studies and gender studies, for example, have succumbed almost entirely not only to moral relativism but epistemic relativism. English literature, too, in my experience, is teaching a thoroughly postmodern orthodoxy. Philosophy, as we have seen, is divided. So is history. Empirical historians are often criticized by the postmodernists among us for claiming to know what really happened in the past. Christopher Butler recalls Diane Perkis's accusation that Keith Thomas was enabling a myth that grounded men's historical identity in the powerlessness and speechlessness of women, when he provided evidence that accused witches were usually powerless beggar women. Presumably, he should have claimed, against the evidence, that they were wealthy women, or better still, men. As Butler says, it seems as though Thomas's empirical claims here have simply run foul of Perkis's rival organizing principle for historical narrative, that it should be used to support contemporary notions of female empowerment. I encountered the same problem when trying to write about race and gender at the turn of the 17th century. I'd argue that Shakespeare's audiences would not have found Desdemona's attraction to Black Othello, who is Christian and a soldier for Venice, so difficult to understand, because prejudice against skin color did not become prevalent until a little later in the 17th century, when the Atlantic slave trade gained steam, and that religious and national differences were far more profound before that. I was told this was problematic by an eminent professor and asked how black communities in contemporary America would feel about my claim. If today's African Americans felt badly about it was implied, it either could not have been true in the 17th century, or it is morally wrong to mention it. As Christopher Butler says, postmodernist thought sees the culture as containing a number of perpetually competing stories, whose effectiveness depends not so much on an appeal to an independent standard of judgment, as upon their appeal to the communities in which they circulate. I fear for the future of the humanities. Postmodernism beyond the academy. The dangers of postmodernism are not limited to pockets of society which center on academia and social justice, however. Relativist ideas, sensitivity to language, and focus on identity over humanity or individuality have gained dominance in wider society. It is much easier to say what you feel than rigorously examine the evidence. The freedom to interpret reality according to one's own values feeds into the very human tendency towards confirmation bias and motivated reasoning. It has become commonplace to note that the far right is now using identity politics and epistemic relativism in a very similar way to the postmodern left. Of course, elements of the far right have always been divisive on the grounds of race, gender, and sexuality, and prone to irrational and anti-science views. But postmodernism has produced a culture more widely receptive to this. Kenan Malik describes the shift, quote, "When I suggested earlier that the idea of alternative facts draws upon, quote, a set of concepts that in recent decades have been used by radicals, I was not suggesting that Kellyanne Conway or Steve Bannon, still less Donald Trump, have been reading up on Foucault or Baudrillard. It is rather that sections of academia and of the left have in recent decades helped create a culture in which relativized views of facts and knowledge seem untroubling, and hence made it easier for the reactionary right not just to reappropriate, but also to promote reactionary ideas. This set of concepts threatens to take us back to a time before the Enlightenment, when reason was regarded as not only inferior to faith, but as a sin." James K. A. Smith, Reformed theologian and professor of philosophy, has been quick to see the advantages for Christianity and regards postmodernism as, quote, "a fresh wind of the spirit sent to revitalize the dry bones of the church." In Who's Afraid of Postmodernism? Taking Derrida, Lyotard, and Foucault to Church, he says, "A thoughtful engagement with postmodernism will encourage us to look backward. We will see that much that goes under the banner of postmodern philosophy has one eye on ancient and medieval sources, and constitutes a significant recovery of pre-modern ways of knowing, being, and doing." And postmodernism can be a catalyst for the church to reclaim its faith, not as a system of truth dictated by neutral reason, but rather as a story that requires eyes to see and ears to hear. We on the left should be very afraid of what our side has produced. Of course, not every problem in society today is the fault of postmodern thinking, and it is not helpful to suggest that it is. The rise of populism and nationalism in the US and across Europe are also due to a strong existing far right and the fear of Islamism produced by the refugee crisis. Taking a rigidly anti-SJW stance and blaming everything on this element of the left is itself rife with motivated reasoning and confirmation bias. The left is not responsible for the far right or the religious right or secular nationalism, but it is responsible for not engaging with reasonable concerns reasonably and thereby making itself harder for reasonable people to support. It is responsible for its own fragmentation, purity demands, and divisiveness, which make even the far right appear comparatively coherent and cohesive. In order to regain credibility, the left needs to recover a strong, coherent, and reasonable liberalism. To do this, we need to out-discourse the postmodern left, we need to meet their oppositions, divisions, and hierarchies with universal principles of freedom, equality, and justice. There must be a consistency of liberal principles in opposition to all attempts to evaluate or limit people by race, gender, or sexuality. We must address concerns about immigration, globalism, and authoritarian identity politics currently empowering the far right, rather than calling people who express them racist, sexist, or homophobic, and accusing them of wanting to commit verbal violence. We can do this whilst continuing to oppose authoritarian factions of the right who genuinely are racist, sexist, and homophobic, but can now hide behind a facade of reasonable opposition to the postmodern left. Our current crisis is not one of left versus right, but of consistency, reason, humility, and universal liberalism versus inconsistency, irrationalism, zealous certainty, and tribal authoritarianism. The future of freedom, equality, and justice looks equally bleak whether the postmodern left or the post-truth right wins this current war. Those of us who value liberal democracy and the fruits of the Enlightenment and scientific revolution and modernity itself must provide a better option. Thank you for listening.